Now, in a moment, is it now finally full-blown civil war between Palestinians? But first, Iraq is reeling following a second attack on the revered Shiite mosque in Samarra. Today's bombing comes just over a year after the first attack on the mosque unleashed the ongoing sectarian violence. After today's attacks, which destroyed the two remaining minarets of the Askariya Shrine about 60 miles north of Baghdad, Shiite leaders, including the cleric Muqtada al-Sadr, called for calm. But the bloc of lawmakers loyal to al-Sadr suspended its membership in parliament. Iraq's Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki ordered extra security at Iraq's other religious shrines and mosques. He's also asking for more U.S. troops for Samarra, where right now there are only a few hundred American troops. New York Times reporter Damian Cave joins us from Baghdad. Damian, first, what's the feeling there? I mean, are people reacting to this?
It's still very hard to tell. There's a curfew here in Baghdad and in many of the mixed cities where you would expect reaction to be strong. That said, there have definitely been signs of a few protests. I just got a report from a Sunni area in Baghdad that just had three or four mortars land on it, where Iraqi army soldiers are telling all the residents to stay inside. At this point, there's just a sense of tension and of wondering whether or not this will once again erupt in more violence.
Yeah. Early reports were saying that the attacks might have been in response to a literal changing of the guard at the mosque from Sunnis to Shiites. Again, it's a Shiite mosque, but there was concern that the Sunni guards had been infiltrated by al-Qaeda, so there was a move to make this change. Do you know more about that?
The situation in Samarra is a bit tricky. It's virtually all Sunni area, and the forces there that had controlled the shrine, some of them were believed to be infiltrated by al-Qaeda, according to American and Iraqi officials up there. They still, however, managed to protect the shrine since the last attack last February. So at this point, it's still, reports are still a bit sketchy as to what significance this changing of the guard might have been. If it was, in fact, a group from Baghdad that came up and, as some reports are saying, were chanting sectarian Shiite slogans, then that's the kind of thing that may set off those groups or other groups nearby. Mm-hmm. But at this point, it's quite possible that a changing of the guard had absolutely nothing to do with this, and this is just another attempt by Sunni extremists to ratchet up the violence and to once again unite Sunnis against Shiites in the wake of recent reports that there have been resistance to al-Qaeda among Sunni tribes and other groups.
What do you make of the call for calm from al-Sadr as his large bloc, 30 members, pulls out of parliament?
Well, it's a very interesting, shrewd move that in some ways underscores the tension between Sadr and the government of Prime Minister Nouri Kamal al-Maliki. In his statement, he criticizes the government for failing to protect the shrine, and he's withdrawing from the government and making a demand that the government go and rebuild the shrine. So in many ways, what's going on here is he's trying to distance himself from the Iraqi government, of which he is a part. So there's an interesting kind of play that's going on here. The call for calm is pretty standard. I mean, this has happened after several large attacks. There's a standard response, which is the call for calm, at least publicly. What happens on the streets and what happens behind the scenes may not necessarily correspond with those pronouncements. But from a purely political rhetoric perspective, the thing that's interesting about Sadr's statement today is that it's an effort to blame the Shiite-led government in addition to the Sunni groups that are believed to have attacked the shrine.
Right. Well, this all comes as you write that wary glances have turned to stony stares. That there's really been a hardening of positions. Iraq's political leaders failed to reach agreements in nearly every law that Americans, especially Congress, have demanded as benchmarks. It is early on, but how would you characterize today's bombing? Some sort of tipping point or turning point, or just part of the, you know, the ongoing chronology of violence?
At this point, it's still very early to tell, but it seems to be another incremental complication after a series of complications. The Iraqi government at this point is deadlocked. It's like a knot that no one can seem to untie. And this kind of thing only contributes to the sense of distrust and an unwillingness to compromise that the Americans have become increasingly frustrated with. You know, whether or not it leads to dramatic increases of violence remains unknown. It's already very violent. And so how much it can increase is the question that still hasn't been answered, and we'll see, frankly, over the next days and weeks and months.
Damian Cave, New York Times, speaking to us from Baghdad. Damian, thanks so much.
Sure, thank you.
As Iraq teeters, are Palestinians in a civil war? After nearly a week of attacks among Palestinian factions, the violence that's left more than 50 people dead has become more organized. Hamas, the Islamist militant group now part of the Palestinian government, has taken control of most of northern Gaza. The fighting has spread to the West Bank city of Nablus. A spokesperson for Hamas says the more moderate Fatah coalition run by President Abbas is corrupt. Joining us on the line is Dr. Rashid Khalidi, director of the Middle East Institute at Columbia University in New York. He's speaking to us from France. His latest book is The Iron Cage, the story of the Palestinian struggle for statehood. Dr. Khalidi, to the main players first. Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas is said to have called the leader of Hamas today and told him this madness has to stop. So the leader of Hamas, where is he? Who is he?
Khaled Mash'al is based in Damascus. He's the head of the political bureau of Hamas. And he is probably the main leader of Hamas, though it's very hard to tell.
Yeah, he's in exile. Why is this fighting at this level happening now?
I mean, there are macro reasons and there are micro reasons. I think the macro reasons are that Fatah really could not accept the idea of sharing power with Hamas, even though it lost in a parliamentary election back in January of 2006.
Fatah, we should say, had been in power for decades.
That's correct. Fatah had dominated the Palestinian National Movement and then the Palestinian Authority really for several decades. And they sort of thought of themselves as the natural government, the natural party of government. And they took their defeat was ill-graced. The second major macro reason is that they were encouraged in this anti-democratic and authoritarian behavior by a constellation of international forces, starting with the United States and the EU and Israel. Hamas had won an election.
There's no question that the U.S. government was unhappy with Hamas winning in that election. But we also understand that Fatah has really been frustrated with the Hamas demand that Israel be dismantled. Tim McGurk, Jerusalem bureau chief of Time magazine, told us last week that there were increasing signs that Hamas was readying for a third intifada against Israel, recruiting female suicide bombers. Because Hamas was growing increasingly desperate at being, you know, a world pariah because of its stand that Israel should be dismantled.
Well, I think that's putting the cart before the horse. There was a perfect opportunity to draw Hamas into a government that would have negotiated with Israel. This was absolutely unacceptable to the United States. As the report of the United Nations rapporteur, which was made public yesterday, published in The Guardian in England, makes clear, the United States wanted a Palestinian civil war. It armed, trained, supported, and financed Fatah in order to prevent a Palestinian coalition government that might have moved towards negotiations with Israel. The United States has a religious attitude towards Hamas. They are, quote-unquote, terrorists. They are beyond the pale. They must not be dealt with. The idea of bringing them into a coalition government and starting a negotiation with a party that won an election simply wouldn't occur to the ideologues in Washington. So saying Hamas is readying suicide bombers or whatever Tim McGurk said, I think, again, misses a year and a half of events where there were numerous opportunities to change the course of events. Now, I'm not trying to take responsibility away from either Fatah or Hamas, who behaved, in my view, irresponsibly and stupidly in all of this, but I think to obscure the role of the United States, Israel, and the European Union is fundamentally mistaken. The Palestinian Authority was entirely financed by these actors, or through these actors, and they, by cutting off finance, basically brought the Palestinians to the brink of collapse.
Well, I want to get to more about who the other players are besides Hamas and Fatah, but you mentioned the religious devotion, and some would say that Hamas, you may be more optimistic than others that Hamas was going to relinquish its thinking about Israel, was going to be able to talk to Israel about a two-state solution. But meantime, here we are, and I understand there's an Egyptian mediation team. Is either side listening to them?
No. I think that things have probably gone beyond that, at least for the moment. I'm afraid that the Palestinian Authority is crumbling. I'm afraid that sooner or later Israel is probably going to find itself with the responsibility that it always had as occupying power for this population, which is basically still under occupation, even though Israel has evacuated the Gaza Strip. It controls it completely from without. It cuts off food, water, whatever it wants, electricity, fuel. It's cut off money for a year and a half. And sooner or later, I think, largely because of the fecklessness of the two Palestinian factions in reacting to this international siege, their complete irresponsibility, I think the Palestinian Authority is going to collapse. So I don't think we're talking about a new intifada. I think we're talking about a situation which is even graver than that. if that can be imagined. So I'm far from being optimistic. I'm actually quite pessimistic.
Is it already civil war?
Well, in Gaza, it has been. I mean, that's what we finally come to. I mean, when you have people tossed off of high buildings, when you have people dragged out in the street and have 40 bullets put into them, as happened to a Fatah leader the other day at the hands of Hamas, I think you're talking about civil war. Now, it may be stoppable, but as of this moment, it does not look good.
If the U.S. is backing Fatah financially, who's backing Hamas financially?
Well, both financially and militarily. Hamas is backed by Syria, by Iran, by a lot of supporters, I think, all over the Arab world, both Palestinian and Arab, who are fed up with the factlessness, the weakness, the inability to achieve anything of Fatah. It also has popular support. Remember, they won an election back in January 2006.
Tell us a little more about the criticism of Fatah from Hamas. I mean, Fatah is accusing Hamas of, you know, madness and violence, including their stand on Israel's right to exist. But what is Hamas saying of Fatah?
Well, Hamas's criticism is one that actually won it a lot of these votes back in January 2006. It's talked about Fatah as having failed to negotiate with Israel, as having failed to end the occupation, as having failed to stop the relentless growth of settlements in the occupied territories, as being corrupt, as being basically unfit to govern. And this is why they want a majority. It's not that a majority of people are committed to the broad tenets of Hamas's political program or anything else. It's that they were really voting against the governing party that had been in power for so very long and had done so very little in the eyes of most people.
Talking about some of the other players, we spoke of, you know, who might be backing both Fatah and Hamas. The Washington Post is reporting that Iran is also said to be aiding Hamas, odd to some because Hamas is seen as a Sunni group, Iran Shiite. How much is this a proxy battle between Hamas and Fatah?
Well, certainly in the eyes of Washington, it is. Washington sees everything in black and white terms. They have no, there's no shade of gray in their you know, way of seeing things. Neither in Lebanon nor in Palestine nor in Iraq nor anywhere else does our government, unfortunately, see reality and in this case see anything gray. Certainly, there is an element of Iranian support for Hamas. There's no question of that, as well as Syrian support. To the extent to which they are proxies for these countries, I wouldn't say that. And I would say the same thing about Fatah. They're being accused, each side is being accused by the other, of being no more than pawns for the great powers outside, and I think that's basically false.
Dr. Rashid Khalidi, director of the Middle East Institute at Columbia University in New York. His latest book is The Iron Cage, the story of the Palestinian struggle for statehood. Well, when we come back, we'll examine who some of the other players might or might not be. Is Al-Qaeda involved in the increased violence in the territories? And later in the program, documentary filmmaker Frederick Wiseman's latest project. He has a cinema verite of state politics and somehow makes what others might think is boring beautiful. Back after a quick break, here and now. Now we're back with more from Dr. Rashid Khalidi, director of the Middle East Institute at Columbia University and author of the book The Iron Cage, the story of the Palestinian struggle for statehood, in which he pretty much blames all parties in the Middle East for the current crisis, including all Palestinian factions. Dr. Khalidi, Sarah Lawrence Professor Fawaz Jurjis recently told us that Hamas and Fatah are nationalist movements. They're not interested in the Islamist militancy of Al-Qaeda. He writes today, though, that there is danger of that changing, and we saw the Al-Qaeda-influenced group infiltrating the Palestinian refugee camp in Lebanon. So what is the role of Al-Qaeda in the Palestinian territories?
As far as one can tell, they have no role at all. There probably is some tiny presence of individuals who are, as it were, Al-Qaeda wannabes. But the danger is that as part of what is developing into an American-Iranian Cold War all over the Middle East, the kind of horrible situation we saw in Nahr al-Bared camp in northern Lebanon, where people who are alien to the camp, who are hated by the camp inhabitants, who don't represent, as you said, the sort of nationalism that Professor Jurjis talked about as characterizing most Palestinians, will get involved. Now, it has not yet happened in any major way in the Gaza Strip or the West Bank, but the fact that it's happened both in the Ain al-Helwi camp near Saida and most notably in the Nahr al-Bared camp near Tripoli in Lebanon is a very ominous sign, I think.
No. Dr. Rashid Khalidi, right in this moment today, what do you think is going to happen? I mean, you know, Hamas has said that they're going to march to Fatah President Abbas's compound.
Well, I don't know what's going to happen, obviously, on the ground, but I can tell you that on the broader level, which is the only level I think is important, the Palestinian Authority's days are numbered. And sooner or later, Israel is going to be stuck with deciding what to do with the 4.5 million Palestinians under its occupation, who the Palestinian Authority partially took off its hands for the better part of a decade and a half.
Do you think, when you say the Palestinian Authority is going to fall, do you think it will be replaced by Hamas solely?
No, I don't think there's going to be any authority. I think there's going to be a situation where there will not be anybody who represents, unfortunately, the Palestinians in the occupied territories. Sooner or later, this system is going to break down. I mean, it's being starved of funds anyway. There is no government. What with what the United States, Europe, and Israel have done, Israel has kept tax revenues generated by the Palestinians themselves, which belong to them, about $500,000, from the Palestinian Authority on the pretext that it's dominated by Hamas. So streets don't get paid, teachers don't get paid, hospitals can't function. So government has stopped for about a year and a half. And it's simply charity that keeps people alive. The Europeans and the United States have pumped money in as charity. Well, that doesn't help create governance. And so governance is stopped or stopping.
Israel, of course, has said that they're withholding the funds, the tax funds from polling stations and others,
right,
because Hamas hasn't formally renounced its desire to dismantle the Jewish state.
Right. Of course, Israel could have explored trying to negotiate with the coalition government that emerged from the Mecca Accords and which was authorized to negotiate, but it chose not to, even though many voices in Israel, if you follow the Israeli debate, in that debate, many voices were raised by people within the security establishment and without, saying we really should negotiate with Hamas. And so all the ridiculous taboos and bugaboos, which we all talk about and which is the only thing that the media seems interested in, are completely ignored in the Israeli internal debate. They know perfectly well that they could conceivably negotiate with Hamas. They choose not to.
And is it too late for that now?
Well, at this stage, I'm afraid it is, yes. I'm afraid there may be nobody to really maybe nobody to negotiate with. That was the cry of the Israelis for years and years. Can't negotiate with Arafat. Can't negotiate with Abbas. Can't negotiate with Hamas. Very soon, it'll be true.
Your family has deep roots in Jerusalem. I think I can hear in your voice that this is affecting you personally.
I don't think there's any Palestinian who's unaffected by this. I mean, this is one of these crises in modern Palestinian history, where, you know, the Palestinians once again look like they might be submerged. I think Palestinian society, as always, will pull through, but the political formations here seem to be heading straight for the wall. Fatah seems to me to have completely lost its raison d'etre. And by this internecine killing, I think Hamas has lost a lot of what internal legitimacy it has. I think both parties have acted reprehensibly and irresponsibly.
What, if anything, can the U.S. do? If the U.S. is, in fact, backing Fatah...
What can the U.S. do?
Mm-hmm.
The U.S. can change its policy fundamentally. It can work immediately to try and bring about a ceasefire between both Palestinians and Palestinians and Palestinians in Israel, which it has not tried to do. It would have to press Israel to move for a ceasefire not only in the Gaza Strip region but in the West Bank, which has been a Palestinian demand for months and years, and a year and a half rather, and Israel has steadfastly refused and insists on going into the West Bank. It can start working towards comprehensive negotiations to resolve the conflict, which this administration has steadfastly refused to do for 6.5 years and counting. And it can stop trying to play this Cold War game with Iran in every nook and cranny of the Middle East, destroying, I think, countries like Lebanon and Palestine in the process. This is not entirely the fault of the United States by any means. The Palestinians bear the major share of responsibility, but the United States, by its blind ideological foreign policy in the Middle East, has helped to destroy now a third country. Iraq is in a shambles. Lebanon is teetering. And Palestine, I think, is going over the edge.
In your book...
The function of American foreign policy.
In your book, and when you say Palestine, the country that could be, because as we know, it's now the territories, but in your book, The Iron Cage, you are as critical of the Palestinians as you've just been, as you are critical of other players. But just staying with the Palestinians for a second, we've often heard people wonder on this program, people like yourself immersed in the region, why isn't there someone who rises up? Why isn't there a Nelson Mandela who can rise up for the Palestinian people? Do you ask yourself that?
Well, you know, there may have been there may have been such a person, but I would look, if I were going to look at where they went in the last 20 or 30 years, at the people who have died at the hands of assassins, Israeli or Arab, or at some of the people who have been languishing in Israeli jails. Unfortunately, the Palestinians have been very unlucky in their leadership, and partly that's their fault, but partly it's been a function of the absolute ruthlessness of their enemies. As I mentioned in my book, a very large proportion of the leadership of the historic Palestinian National Movement fell victim to assassination, largely by Israel, but also by the intelligence services of Arab powers. So that Nelson Mandela may well be in the grave somewhere, or languishing, as I say, in an Israeli prison.
Dr. Rashid Khalidi, director of the Middle East Institute at Columbia University in New York, author of The Iron Cage and a Palestinian. Dr. Khalidi, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Not at all.
Okay, tomorrow on Here and Now, the best-selling author of 1,000 Splendid Sons. That's tomorrow. Still ahead, mill blogging after the news. Here and Now. Support for Here and Now comes from the Now. Loose lips sink ships. That's the World War II motto about keeping secrets from the enemy. These days, the U.S. military is increasingly worried about what's being said online by U.S. troops, their friends, and their families. Military bloggers are in an uproar following a story in Wired magazine last week about a new Army regulation. It calls for all soldiers to consult with their supervisor before posting information in a public forum, and that includes letters, resumes, and email. The next day, the Army had to issue a clarification, but there's still confusion. So to start, we asked Paul Boyce, the Army spokesperson, to explain the rule.
When you are first setting up your blog, you need to consult with your superiors to let them know that you, in fact, are blogging. And then, ultimately, you need to receive a briefing on the sorts of things that you should avoid. For instance, one of the big ones that we try and avoid is anything that deals with our tactics, techniques, training, and procedure that would benefit the enemy. A good example of that that most people are familiar with is don't put out there what time your convoy is leaving from Baghdad or from Kuwait and where they're headed to and what time they're expected to get there. Mm-hmm. And those are the sorts of things that you alluded to that actually date back to World War II. Mm-hmm. Ironically, your interview is running around the time of June the 6th, and everyone knows historically what happened on D-Day. We had more than 160,000 people landing on the beach, and by the end of that day, we had 9,000 killed soldiers and wounded. What we're trying to do here is far more modest than what was being done in World War II, with actually having Patton simulate the invasion of Calais. All we're asking for is cooperation to avoid putting out information that could potentially jeopardize people's lives. Well, we're not looking to restrict information, though.
But again, we're trying to clarify. You, in fact, put out a fact sheet the day after the Wired magazine story, which, again, seemed to say that not even an email could be sent without clearance. You wrote, "In no way will every blog post be monitored or have to get approved," meaning, as I think I'm hearing you say again, that just the initial blog is the one that has to be approved.
And I want to clarify, if you have any confusion that we're going to look at your emails, I want to dispel that right now. That's not the case. There is no way that we could look at all the emails. We're not going to try and restrict information. We're not going to look at the blogs. But we are asking that you not publish classified information or things that would jeopardize a soldier's life.
Why didn't the regulation then just say, consult with your supervisor when you're setting up a blog?
And it
from
does.
And from, well, it's not, again, it looks like it says every time you blog or email.
Well, what they're trying to get to is if you've got a doubt after you've done that initial orientation, if you've got something that you're not for certain about, do check it out. So is that a continuing responsibility? Yes. So if you believe that after you've done the initial check, you can do anything you want, that's not the case. Every day, all of us are reminded of the importance of maintaining classified information. And that's just the nature of what we do. We're in the national defense business.
That's Army spokesman Paul Boyce speaking to us about the new rule regarding military blogging. Well, we want to turn now to Noah Shachtman. He covers national security for Wired magazine and wrote the initial article about the new regulation. Noah, as you know, after your story, the Army then released a fact sheet clarification, and we just heard from Army spokesperson Paul Boyce. Is this new regulation clarified for you?
Well, it's not clarified for me exactly. I mean, look, one thing you've got to remember is that a regulation, and you quoted the regulation, has the force of law. That fact sheet clarification they have came out of the public relations office. So it has the force of spin. So you've got the force of law versus the force of spin. So I think you know which one a commander is going to pay attention to.
Well, this is one of the concerns that bloggers are registering. They say that the clarification won't be disseminated as effectively as the regulation is, so people may not even know about it. But let's get to that clarification, because the American Enterprise Institute looked at this, and although they agree, they feel that there are significant downsides to the regulation, they feel that you, in particular, in the Wired article, may have misread the regulation and missed the word public forum. For instance, the clarification says troops can send any personal email they want. The public forum is the key to the regulation. These are things that are posted on public forums.
Well, I mean, that's nice that the Army's public relations officers are trying to walk back an unwieldy regulation. Nevertheless, what the regulation itself says is that before you send out an email, before you send out a resume, before you send out a letter home, or before you publish a blog...
In a public forum, though. Email on a public forum.
Well, look, you could argue that the Internet itself is a public forum. You can consider everything to be verboten and everything to be secret, and pretty soon you're left with no information at all. And I don't think that that is actually helpful. In fact, I think that information sharing is what we need more of in the military, not more information hoarding.
Isn't that a reasonable concern, though? I mean, let's just, you know, just ask you on behalf of the spokesperson. Look, you know, if you're trying to have a secret operation and all of your troops and civilians that you don't even have any, the civilian contractors you don't have much control over, have access to the Internet, isn't that something to be concerned about?
Look, there have been none, zero examples of breaches of classified information because of blogs or social network sites. Colby Bazell was reprimanded for perhaps releasing too much details about a firefight after the fact, but nothing that he published was considered classified, and no one ever accused him of leaking classified information. Look, soldiers are told from day one that real secrets have to be kept secrets, and they are very good about doing that. What the regulations cover is unclassified information, okay? They want to regulate a whole body of information that is specifically not secret.
Can I just ask you, is one other issue that there are on-the-radar named bloggers, and then there are off-the-radar anonymous bloggers. And I've heard both that the anonymous bloggers aren't going to pay any attention to the regulations, or that the anonymous bloggers have the most to fear because they're writing the most important, maybe of concern to the military information, and they're soon going to disappear because they'll be afraid of the, you know, the ramifications of the regulation.
I'm not sure how it's going to play out. I think the other thing to keep in mind is that these regulations are only one small part of a bigger piece. For example, the Army has a 10-person, the Army National Guard in Virginia has a 10-person unit whose job it is to go and sniff out websites, including blogs, for possible what they consider to be operational security violations.
Is this the Army Web Risk Assessment Team?
Risk Assessment Cell. And they are not looking exclusively for classified information, nor, to the best of my knowledge, have they found any blogs that have leaked any classified information. There's a real conflict going on within the military. Some in the military really want to embrace these technologies and others don't.
Noah Shachman covers national security for Wired. He writes the Danger Room blog for that magazine. Noah, thanks so much.
Thanks.
And before we go today, Director Frederick Wiseman watches grass grow and flower in Idaho as he documents democracy in action. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, now it's time to hear from some of you. Diane Gurian of Intervale, New Hampshire, wrote recently to say she appreciated our conversation with Iraqi Abdullah Omar about the new wall built by U.S. forces to keep his Baghdad neighborhood safe. Omar said it only made it harder to visit his parents. Well, Diane writes, it was my understanding that the wall project had been canceled and it all but disappeared from the news. Your report today was the first time I heard that, in fact, the wall had been built. Thanks for keeping us up to date. We also spoke recently with siblings Elizabeth and Andrew Hsu, whose new film Gracie was inspired by the death of their older brother and Elizabeth's memories of being the only girl on an all-boys soccer team. Landis Hershey of North Attleboro, Massachusetts writes, in the late 70s, I played on my high school co-ed JV team and played a lot. Then I was put on the all-boys varsity team, sat on the bench and was teased. Not the greatest experience. But I look at all the female athletes now and know I helped them and was part of history. Deb Becker spoke recently with a representative of Holosonics Incorporated. That's the company that claims to send sound to individual listeners with what they call audio spotlight technology. Hussein Merpay of Royal Oak, Michigan, wrote with a cautionary note. He says, I shop at a grocery chain here in Michigan that has these directional speakers in the checkout line. I can't empty my cart without hearing about a new soda brand or a TV show. And because the checkout line doesn't have much space, I'm forced to either bend down and slump over my cart or lean on the candy rack just to avoid feeling like an advertiser has put headphones on me. In this situation, I dislike audio spotlights very much. Well, we always get questions about music, and following our piece on a new documentary about the controversy between evolution and the countervailing theory of intelligent design, Charles Vigeron of Walla Walla, Washington asked, what music did you play? Well, Charles, it was appropriately enough, Origin of Species by Chris Smither. Here's a little more.
Well, Charlie Darwin looked so far into the way things are, he caught a glimpse of God's unfolding plan. God said, I'll make some DNA, they can use it any way they want, from paramecium right up to man. They'll have sex and mix up sections of their code, they'll have mutations, the whole thing works like clockwork over time. I'll just sit back in the shade while everyone gets laid, that's what I call intelligent design.
We also did a story recently on the Dark Star Orchestra, a Grateful Dead cover band. How good are they? Well, we asked listeners to distinguish between the Dead and the DSO on the anthem Jack Straw. Now, here's the Grateful Dead. And here's the DSO. Well, Deadhead John Wagner of Eugene, Oregon, has been to 10 DSO concerts, 576 Grateful Dead shows. He guessed correctly that we played Dark Star Orchestra because, as he writes, the vocals are the giveaway, DSOs are better. And finally, after our salute to the last Sopranos show, the one with the, huh, what just happened ending, listener Dave Swoboda of Billings, Montana, pointed out there may have been a musical cue.
At the beginning of the show, there was music that was performed way back in the late 60s by Vanilla Fudge. And it was their version of the song that Diana Ross and the Supremes did called You Keep Me Hanging On. And I think that was pretty much a premonition of the ending for the episode.
Set me free, why don't you, babe? Get out my life, why don't you, babe? You really don't want me. You just keep me hanging on.
You think? Don't leave us hanging. Let us hear from you. Our address is letters@here-now.org or give us a call, 617-358-0397. Please remember to give us your full name and town. After a quick break, documentary filmmaker Fred Wiseman turns his cameras on the Idaho State Legislature here and now. Now, and it's action film season. So imagine this cinematic event. long debates between citizens and lawmakers about issues ranging from secondhand smoke to regulating building contractors to how to handle video voyeurs to defining marriage in the state of Idaho.
I do not believe that our Supreme Court is going to overturn our defense of marriage statute.
Currently, we have nothing in Idaho to help us with the issues that are coming up, especially with the new technology that is out on the market right now and dealing with video voyeurism.
People are demanding to have smoke-free, real smoke-free areas in the places that they go to dine.
We want to get out in front of this a little bit. The average person has really no idea what to do with their electronic waste.
You'd think it would be like watching paint dry, but this is a Frederick Wiseman film. This is the man who trained his camera on grisly mental hospitals and grimy meatpacking plants and kept us glued to the screen. He does the same with State Legislature. It's the new documentary that begins tonight on PBS. It's a film that follows Idaho's 2004 legislative session, and it's become one of the most talked about films of the Berlin International Film Festival. Frederick Wiseman is on the line. He joins us from Paris. Welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
So I'm wondering if you were setting us up, because I confess I had a preconception I was going to be bored, and I wasn't.
No, I'm playing with the preconception. I mean, it's what I set myself up for, in the sense that I've never made a movie yet where the final movie wasn't different than my fantasy about what it was going to be in advance. And the movie is really concerned with the process of how information is presented to the legislators, how they make decisions, how they propose laws, and particularly these days when there's so much talk about exporting democracy, I thought it would be interesting to show the kind of consensus that's required on the part of the citizens of a state and among the legislators to have it function at all.
Right at the top, there's an exchange between the Speaker of the House, who's a rancher for the other 9 months of the year. This is a citizen legislature, a non-professional job for these people. And he's explaining to a group of students what it means to be a citizen legislator. Let's listen to a little bit.
The thing I have to say about this process is one of the best there is, because the citizens legislature, what we are, is we do this, what we do, and basically we get paid about enough to meet our expenses. So it's a wash. You don't really make any money at this. You know, I like that in the sense that it's public service. And two, I get to go home and live with what I did to myself. But it also makes me very cognizant of the fact that I are one of my constituents.
They are considering things like whether cattle coming in from Canada should have microchips to be identified, whether kids should be forced to go to kindergarten. Apparently, they discover that 200 are staying home. As you said, they do it in the most civic-minded, gracious, thoughtful way. I realized at one point I had a tear in my eye as to, you know, how majestic the process is.
Right. You know, it's not a movie about partisan politics. It's a movie about the democratic process and how it requires both a formal and an informal contract between the citizens of the state and the legislators that this is the way laws are going to be made and this is the way policy is going to be determined.
We have a scene where you catch a couple legislators in the well of this beautiful Idaho Capitol building, and they're waiting for some process to start, and they're just kind of talking off the cuff their concerns about whether or not they're getting it right. Let's listen.
You know, we really screwed up yesterday. Was it yesterday? We didn't run the roll call on the phone vote.
Yeah, you did.
I was arguing.
Run the roll call, and
and that's an important roll call.
Yeah,
I was thinking this morning, I guess people can find it on the website and all that, but it should have been published.
Well,
what do you think is going to happen on the other side?
I don't know. The fact that it was so close in the House, maybe it's possible to slow it down or stop it in the Senate. I don't know. The phone company is lobbying like mad, you know, and even some of the governor's administrators are contacting legislators and saying vote for this. And, of course, organized labor is involved also, and that's why we lost a couple of Democrats on that vote.
Do you think, Frederick Wiseman, that they were adjusting their tone of voice or their concerns or anything because you were there?
No, I don't think so. You know, that's an issue that I'm always sensitive to, whether it's in this film or any of the other films that I made. But, I mean, the test I use is the same test that anybody uses that meets a lot of people all the time, whether you're a doctor, a filmmaker, radio interviewer or a television commentator or whatever, or a used car salesman, you're sensitive to the possibility of being conned. And if you think that's what's happening, you don't use it.
Plus, you sort of wait them out because you're there for so long and the camera's rolling for so long that, you know, after 15, 20 minutes of debate, they couldn't possibly be faking it.
I think most people don't fake it because I don't think they have the capacity to fake it. If they did, then the level of acting in Hollywood and Broadway would be much higher than it is because it would be a wider pool to choose from.
We see passions, but we see plenty of the mundane. There's the mail cart making its way through these beige governmental offices, clerks filing, collating. Someone at a certain point has a rule book open. They're trying to figure out what the rules are. Footsteps echoing across marble floors, the rotunda of the legislative building, under which we see, you know, lobbyists and people, you know, pushing for their side of an issue. We're hearing that people in Europe are just going crazy over this film. What are they saying?
It's an illustration of how democracy works, and they haven't seen how American democracy works in these terms, and so they're fascinated by it.
And we're hearing impressed. I mean, these people in Idaho giving up long hours in beige rooms seem very noble at the end of the film.
That runs counter to the cliche that legislators are totally under the influence of lobbyists or that they're corrupt or whatever. I think by and large, I mean, I'm not saying there were no corrupt legislators. I don't really know whether there were or there weren't in Idaho. But I would say that most of the people that I saw in the legislature took the job very seriously. It doesn't mean that one has to agree with their political positions, but the most that one can ask for is that they take their job seriously and pay attention and consider the complexities of the issues. I mean, not just people in Europe. I think most of us, while we have opinions about the political process or about the legislative process, have no real experience. And the reality is much more complicated.
Frederick Wiseman, as you put it together, did you ever have any thought of, you know, let me just cut this together. Let me make this shorter. Let me speed this up. Let me, you know, because people don't have long attention spans, you know.
No, I think that I have a responsibility to the people that gave me permission to make the film to make a film that fairly represents what I found in the course of making the movie. So that's why the film's a long film. If I were going to make it an hour and a half, I don't think it would be fair.
Frederick Wiseman, he's the dean of Cinema Verite, and his new film is called State Legislature. It begins airing tonight on PBS stations. For local listings, go to our website, here-now.org. We're going to leave you with the only music from the film, a chorus of kids from the White Pine School singing Swing Low, Sweet Chariot, under the rotunda of the Capitol building.
Swing low, sweet chariot, coming for to carry me home. Swing low, sweet chariot, coming for to carry me home.
Fred, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young.